Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On June 16th, 2018, Jermaine Charlot left a bar in Missoula, Montana, and was never seen again. Jermaine was just 23 years old and a single mom to two young boys, Thomas and Jacob. She was a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and lived on the Flathead Reservation, which is just north of Missoula. Jermaine would have celebrated her 26th birthday on April 23rd, just a couple of days ago. In her new 8-part podcast, Stolen, The Search for Jermaine, Cree journalist Connie Walker takes listeners through Jermaine's case and tries to find out what happened to her through interviews with family, friends, and those still searching for answers. For the last 2 years, the Missoula, Montana Police Department has been investigating Jermaine's case, which remains open. Jermaine is just one of more than 5,500 Indigenous women and girls who are currently reported missing or murdered in the FBI's National Crime Information Center database. Advocates say that number is likely much higher. We don't know the actual number because no one is keeping track. We do know that 84% of Indigenous women have experienced physical, sexual, or psychological abuse. More than 1 in 2 Indigenous women have experienced sexual violence in their lifetimes. Native women are the victims of murder at more than 10 times the national average, according to the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Connie Walker says just being born an Indigenous woman in the U.S. made Jermaine more likely to become a victim of violence. Connie Walker is an award-winning Cree journalist from Saskatchewan, Canada. Connie spent the majority of her career at Canada's CBC News Network, where she hosted the Missing and Murdered podcast and investigated the cases of missing Indigenous women like Leah Anderson and Alberta Williams. Connie's new podcast with Gimlet Media is called Stolen, The Search for Jermaine. And here is how Connie started episode 1, Long Dark Alley.
A quick warning before we start the show. This series contains descriptions of adult subject matter, including details of violence and trauma. Please take care while listening. So much of my work, and really my life, is spent immersed in the lives of women that I can never meet. Women who have been stolen from their families and communities. Women whose lives have been cut short, but who I imagine still need justice. The first woman whose story haunted me was named Pamela George. I was in high school when I first heard about Pamela. She was a Soto woman from the Sacamay First Nation, not far from my own reserve in southern Saskatchewan. Pamela was a single mom with two young kids. In April 1995, she was killed. And because the two men who were charged with her murder were young, white university students, their trial dominated headlines in Canada. News reports described Alex Turnowetsky and Stephen Comerfield's charmed lives. One was a basketball star, the other a hockey standout. But the only thing I remember from the headlines about Pamela was that they called her an Aboriginal prostitute. I remember reading how the two men were out drinking one night in Regina and how one of them hid in the trunk when they picked up Pamela. They took her to the outskirts of the city, sexually assaulted her, and beat her. They left her in the ditch where her body was found the next day. I read about how they bragged about it to one of their friends. They said, "We drove around, got drunk, and killed this chick. She deserved it. She was Indian." They were both acquitted of Pamela George's murder and convicted of manslaughter. They were sentenced to 6.5 years each, but actually served less than 4. I remember feeling outraged, sad, even hopeless when the verdict was announced, as I'm sure every other Indigenous woman and girl in the province did. Not only because of how the justice system devalued Pamela's life, but because of what the judge, jury, media, and society's acceptance of this injustice said about how they valued our lives. We didn't hear about how Pamela was a mother, daughter, sister, auntie, how her life was taken from her children, her family, and her community, and how her death is part of a history of violence against Indigenous women that goes back 500 years to when the land we're all standing on now was stolen. It was the first time I thought about becoming a journalist. But it would be almost 2 decades before I got the green light to report on women like Pamela. The first story I covered was the unsolved murder of Leah Anderson. And then, Amber Tuckero, Trish Carpenter, Alberta Williams, Cleo Semeganis, and now, the disappearance of Jermaine Charlo.
And that is Connie Walker, an award-winning Cree journalist who is host of the incredible new podcast, Stolen, The Search for Jermaine. Hi, Connie. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, huge thanks to you and your team because you did such an amazing job with this podcast. I have to say a lot of it was really hard to listen to. I actually had to press pause a few times to let the information sink in. And as a fellow journalist, Connie, I just kept thinking the process. Can you share information about your process and how you are able to gather so much information and put together these amazing podcasts because it's just excellent work?
Sure. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And that really means a lot. I mean, I know that, you know, I think that in some ways it is such difficult subject matter, that, you know, I think a podcast and a serialized podcast is really kind of the perfect way to kind of unpack these stories because, you know, you mentioned a lot of the terrible statistics that exist around violence against Indigenous women and girls in the United States and in Canada, you know, very similar rates of violence. And I think that what is often missing from a lot of the reporting, and I include my own reporting in this before I had a chance to work in a podcast, is the context, the important pieces of context that are really integral to understanding the lives of women like Pamela George and women like Jermaine Charlo. You know, I think that, you know, in that opening essay from episode one, when I talk about my own experience as, a teenager growing up in Saskatchewan and learning about Pamela George and her story and how that impacted me, what was missing from all of that reporting was, I mean, obviously the context, but also the humanity, you know, really, you know, I think that what's happened in terms of the coverage of Indigenous women and girls in mainstream media is a lot of it has led to a feeling of being dehumanized in terms of some of this reporting and having the space and time that you get to explore not just a person's life or not just the mystery of, you know, Jermaine Charlo's disappearance, but, you know, to explore those bigger contexts and those issues in a podcast, I think as a storyteller and as a journalist, really, you know, it has been transformative for me, I think, in terms of finally getting to do the stories that I really care about and tell them in a way that I feel really does justice to these really important stories that have been ignored for far too long.
And I think you're the perfect person to do this because you're a Cree journalist. You talk about your own experience with trauma as a child, your connection to these women and girls. And in an interview that you conducted recently with Rolling Stone, you talked about what happened when you pitched a story about missing Indigenous women to your boss at a national current affairs show. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. Well, I mean, after, you know, I was in high school when Pamela George was killed and those two men were on trial for her death. And actually around the time they were released from prison, because they actually only served about 4 years, 4.5 years each, was around the time I got my first job in journalism. And I was always interested in reporting on our stories and reporting in our communities. But at that point, you know, there was very little interest in mainstream newsrooms about Indigenous issues in general, unless there was some kind of crisis, unless there was some kind of conflict. And I remember one summer when a girl that I knew from back home had gone missing. And I knew her because she was the same age as my sister. Her name was Amber Redman. And I coached her in volleyball when I was in university. I coached my sister's volleyball team for the Saskatchewan Indian Winter Games. And Amber was one of our girls for one of the years that my cousin Shelley and I coached. And I didn't know her very well, but, you know, I knew her, a little bit. And in 2006, you know, she went missing. And this was before social media. I was working in, you know, in a national newsroom in Toronto, Canada, Ontario, Canada. And, I remember getting, you know, an email chain. You know, we used to forward these emails, please forward before social media to help spread the word. And it was from her family and it was about her disappearance and they were just desperate for information. And Amber's, you know, Amber's case barely got any local news coverage. And that was the same summer that, another woman went missing in Toronto and she was a white woman. And I remember feeling like there were so many similarities between her case and Amber's case, because there were these two young women who had their whole lives in front of them and whose families were just so desperate for any information. But the woman from Toronto, Alicia Ross, like her story was covered in the national newspapers and national newscasts every night. And Amber barely got any local news coverage. And I remember going to pitch a story to my boss about kind of the difference in the media coverage between these two cases. And she held up her hand to me as, you know, before I got really going. And she said, "This isn't another poor Indian story, is it?" And I honestly don't remember what happened after that. I think I obviously, that's as far as I got. And I ended up, you know, leaving her office and feeling terrible. But that was really the attitude, I think, for a long time, that these were not important stories, that people didn't care about women like Amber or women like Pamela George. And I obviously cared. And I think that, you know, it took 10 years, but 10 years later, I was part of a team at CBC that was working, you know, working on reporting on this issue of violence against Indigenous women and girls. And that was 2016 that I finally got to start focusing on that. And once I started, you know, I haven't stopped, and I feel like so lucky in some ways, because this is something I never actually ever dreamed would happen, that there would be, you know, this understanding and recognition that these are important stories. These women's lives and their disappearances and their deaths are so important and we need to understand, and that I would be, you know, given the support and resources to help share these stories, because I do feel, you know, a responsibility as an Indigenous woman and as a journalist to help tell the truth about this reality and about the lives that we live, and stories like Germaine's and Pamela's. You know, I feel very compelled to want to keep doing this.
So going from pitching a piece and hearing an editor say, "This isn't another poor Indian story, is it?" to broadcasting an 8-part incredible podcast with Gimlet Media, focusing on Germaine Charlin, but also the larger issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Can you just tell us, I mean, how many downloads did this podcast? I mean, it's still being downloaded. I was just finishing it this morning, but how many downloads did you get for this one?
Oh my, I feel so unprepared. I have no idea. I've been blown away by the response. I can say that, like, it's been incredible to know that the podcast that our team worked so hard to produce, is being heard by people around the world. I got an email yesterday from someone in Singapore, who says, you know, her life has been changed by hearing Germaine's story, and also from other Indigenous people who are listening and saying, "I feel like you're reporting on my family. I feel like, you know, you're telling part of my story." I got another message from somebody in the UK today, you know, who also experienced violence as a child in her home, like I did, and like I talk about in the podcast, and you know, thanking me for helping to take some of the stigma away from talking about that experience. You know, it's been amazing. I think the most you know, important thing for me is that Germaine's family feels like, you know, that this has been, you know, it's hard to say a good experience, because I don't think it could be a good experience, but that they feel, you know, I think that they're grateful that more people are learning about Germaine and her story, and more people are joining you know, them in their quest for information and for knowledge and for acknowledgement of what's happened to them and the grief that they've been going through the last 2 years, because it's really been agonizing for her family to, you know, to have Germaine, who was this young, bright, funny woman who was so loved by her family and her community, disappear and never be heard from again. And for them to, you know, be seeking answers and not knowing what happened to her for over 2 years, almost 3 years in June, has been agonizing. So, you know, it's fantastic to get all of this positive feedback and to see that Germaine's story is resonating with people. But for her family, you know, this is more than a podcast. This is more than a story. This is, you know, this is their real life. And I never want to lose sight of that either.
When did you first learn about Germaine?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation for 20 years, almost 20 years, and before deciding to join Gimlet Media and start focusing on this issue of violence against Indigenous women and girls in the U.S. And I'm Cree from Saskatchewan, and I grew up in my community, and I'm very connected to my community in Saskatchewan. And I know that this issue of violence against Indigenous women and girls is a huge problem on both sides of the border, in Canada and in the United States. But I didn't want to assume that just because I have my lived experience that I understand, you know, what the situation is in the United States. And so when I decided to join Gimlet, like, one of the first things I wanted to do was try to connect with people who were doing this work in the United States. And similar to Canada, I found that it's largely led by Indigenous women and girls who themselves have been personally impacted by this violence, whether they've lost somebody in their family or they know someone who has been, is gone missing or been murdered, or themselves are survivors of some kind of violence. And what happened in Canada, and what I see is also has happened in the United States, is that then they become advocates and activists and are the ones working to kind of make change and try to prevent this violence in their communities. And so I went to a conference actually in Tucson, Arizona, that was focused on sex trafficking, but you know, you don't have to go too far down to realize that all of these issues are interconnected. And I met a lot of Indigenous women who are doing this work in their communities across the country. And one of them was a woman named Lauren Small Rodriguez. And she is actually in the second episode of our podcast as well. And she works with to prevent sex trafficking in Missoula. She's Indigenous as well. She's Northern Cheyenne from Montana, but she lives in Missoula. And she first told me about Germaine Charlo. And I remember, you know, at that time, unfortunately, like there were just so many unsolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls across the U.S. And they all deserve to have attention and to have resources and to share their story. But I remember when she told me about Germaine, and you know, one of the first things that I read about her that included the photograph that we ended up using in the show art for Stolen. And it looks like it's a selfie, like Germaine's taken the photo of herself. And she's looking straight into the camera, and her eyes are so piercing. I don't know if you found mm-hmm. that when you were looking at the show art, but I just, something about her eyes really grabbed me. And that one of the first articles I read described, you know, the circumstances of her disappearance being that she was, you know, out in downtown Missoula, which is a really vibrant college town. She was probably one of like hundreds of young people out that night enjoying, you know, a summer night in June in Montana. And that she was last seen on surveillance footage, like walking down an alley in downtown Missoula, and that she turned a corner and was never seen again. And that was such a haunting image to me. And immediately I wanted to know more. I wanted to know how could that happen? How could you turn a corner and vanish? And the article also talked to Germaine's, her aunt, Valinda, and, you know, who talked about just how agonizing it's been for her family not to have any answers and not to be able to bring Germaine home after 2 years. Cause I think that was the second anniversary of her disappearance when I read that article. And I think that, you know, there was just so much about Germaine that every little bit that I learned, it just, you know, raised 10 more questions for me, and I wanted to know more. And then one of the first people I actually talked to was the detective in Germaine's case, Detective Guy Baker with the Missoula City Police Department. And in my first conversation with him, Which, you know how these conversations go, the first research call to somebody, you have no idea what to expect. You could go any number of ways. And especially coming from Canada, where I come from, talking to police, those are usually very short conversations where they don't want to tell you very much, especially around an open and active investigation. But we spoke to Detective Guy Baker for an hour that day, and he really laid out, his various theories about what may have happened to Jermaine, and talked about the hundreds of man hours he himself had put into finding Jermaine. He referenced these, 4-inch thick binders that he had relating to her disappearance, and that he had talked to over 90 people. And at the end of that conversation, I knew that I wanted to know more, and that I wanted to, as soon as I could, travel to Montana and connect with Jermaine's family to see if they would be interested in us, pursuing, doing a story, doing a podcast about her disappearance and really about her life. The it's called Stolen, the Search for Jermaine, but it's as much as it is an exploration around trying to find answers relating to her disappearance, it also is very much about everything that led up to that night in her life. I am so grateful that we were able to spend the time and resources. And I feel like I've gotten to know Jermaine a little bit through that journey.
Hey, something struck me. I'm guessing that a lot of people in the U.S. have never been to a reservation. And when you hear about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, people might think that it happens, on a desolate road out on a reservation where very few people are. But we're talking about Missoula, Montana. I mean, this is one of the major city. I mean, Montana is a small state but in terms of population, but it's a major, like you said, college town. It's a really cute town, lots of bars, restaurants. Mm-hmm. And you talk in the podcast about how a lot of Indigenous women go missing in Montana. And you basically raise this question, what is happening in Montana?
Yeah. I mean, and that was, part of what, even before I ever traveled to Missoula, even before I knew about Jermaine Charlo, I had traveled to Montana after going to that conference in Arizona. I met, some of the people behind the Sovereign Bodies Institute, which is an organization that is working to try to create a database of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the U.S., trying to address the other part of the crisis, which is really, understanding the statistics and the numbers and really the scope of the problem. And they had organized an event in February of 2020, in Bighorn County, which is in a completely different part of the state, but where there are so many, unfortunately, cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women and girls, and actually not just women and girls, like men and boys as well. And so in February, I actually traveled to Montana, to Bighorn County, and they had an event there that there was a rally outside the courthouse in Hardin, Montana. And at the end of, and there were, so many families out there, trying to push law enforcement, but also, the justice system in general into doing a better job of not just investigating these cases, but also, doing a better job in terms of the relationships that they have with the family members. And at the end of that day, there was this event for family, where we shared a meal and, people brought photos of their loved ones. There was a picture of Jermaine up there, actually, I remember. And, Kaysera Stops Pretty Places and Selena Not Afraid. And so many of these family members got up and spoke and shared a little bit of their story. And it really helped me illustrate just how common this is, like what a crisis of violence that exists for Indigenous people in our communities. Mm. And it really, there's such a lack of understanding about the scope of this violence in communities. You're right that I don't know how many people have actually been to a reservation or feel like they understand what it's like to be in an Indigenous community. But I think that also speaks to just the underrepresentation that we have in media. You know, there are so few Indigenous journalists in mainstream newsrooms. And there are not enough of us who are supported in bringing these stories into the spotlight and helping to amplify Indigenous voices to tell our own stories about our communities. You know, there's a long history in media of people dropping in and taking stories and you know, leaving, and not having connections to communities, not feeling like a responsibility to those communities. And I think that when we support Indigenous people to tell our own stories, I think that we get a better sense of the truth because we understand the context and we understand how this is connected back to this bigger history. But it's also, I think something that's just starting to happen, and we need to be doing more to support that. Because I think it's, the issue of MMIW or the issue of violence against Indigenous women and girls is really kind of an entry point to really understanding the truth about the lives that Indigenous people live in Canada and in the United States today. Mm-hmm. Because the sad reality is that there is a lot of misinformation and ignorance about that truth.
That is an understatement, Connie. You're so right. And I so appreciate you sharing the story about the history of how Montana was really settled. And we'll talk about that after a break. Connie Walker is an award-winning Cree journalist from Saskatchewan, Canada, and host of the podcast with Gimlet Media called Stolen, The Search for Germaine. On June 16th, 2018, Germaine Charlot left a bar in Missoula, Montana, and was never seen again. Her family is still searching for answers. She was just 23 and a single mom to two young boys. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Connie Walker, an award-winning Cree journalist from Saskatchewan, Canada. Connie spent the majority of her career at Canada's CBC News Network, where she hosted the Missing and Murdered podcast and investigated the cases of many missing Indigenous women. Her new podcast with Gimlet Media is called Stolen, The Search for Germaine. On June 16th, 2018, Germaine Charlot left a bar in Missoula, Montana, and was never seen again, and her family is still searching for answers. Germaine was a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and lived on the Flathead Reservation, which is just north of Missoula. Connie, it's very easy to other people in this country, mm-hmm. well, really around the world. And a lot of people say, oh yeah, there's alcoholism, domestic violence. That's what just happens on the reservations. And there's absolutely no context. In the podcast, you point out that the story of how Montana was settled was repeated or is repeated over and over again. The settler version was that colonists were moving west, encroaching on Indian land. So the parties came together to sign an agreement, and the rest is history. Can you tell us the story? But you do this so beautifully in such a short amount of time. And we're talking about Germaine Charlot's ancestors who did not want to leave their land.
Yeah, I mean, that's another part of, I feel like obviously, like, coming from Canada and being born and raised in Treaty 4 territory in Saskatchewan, I was really fortunate enough to learn about the importance of treaties. I remember actually being a kid and kind of maybe not being that thrilled at having another conversation turn to the importance of treaties. But really now as an adult, I'm so grateful that was instilled in me the importance of the true history of this relationship between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. Because the reality is, like, this is a relationship that goes back 500 years, and that so much of what we understand about that history is from the settler perspective, that there's so much of the Indigenous perspective, whether you're Cree from Saskatchewan or Bitterroot Salish, like Germaine was from Montana, is not known. This is not something that we're taught in schools. We don't understand a lot of the truth about this shared history. And I feel like that's also, a big part of the goal of the podcast is really try to tell the truth about that history. And in for the Bitterroot Salish, now Germaine and her family, like, she grew up and was born and raised on the Flathead Reservation just north of Missoula. But their homeland was actually south of Missoula in the Bitterroot Valley. And they lived there, you know, since time immemorial. And, you know, they didn't want to leave when the settlers came west. They didn't want to leave their homeland. And the Germain Charlot's ancestors refused to leave for decades, actually. And it was because Chief Charlot, which is, you know, an ancestor of Germain Charlot, you know, he held firm and didn't want to move onto the Flathead Reservation. And in the end, what happened was that his signature was forged on a document, and eventually they were marched. They were forced by the army to march north onto the Flathead Reservation. And that is something, you know, that was really important for me to learn that history, because I know that it's connected back to Germain's story in some way. Like, I, you know, this issue of Germain Charlot and the story of her disappearing one night in June, I know that that's not where her story began. And I learned in doing this work and in hearing the stories of Pamela George and Alberta Williams and Cleo Samaganis, all of these women and girls, I know that the situations that they were in and the lives that they lived were connected back to this bigger history and to what has happened to Indigenous people, and what the truth has been about our side of that history, and how we've been impacted by colonization, and how we've been impacted by the institutional racism that results in things like in Canada, residential schools, or in the United States, boarding schools, or how that impacts child welfare legislation, how that impacts violence against women legislation, like all of these things that continue to shape and impact our lives and contribute to this crisis of violence are connected back to this history. So it's really important for me to try to include that history in the podcast, because I know it impacted Germaine's life. I know that it impacted her mother's life, her grandparents, her great-grandparents. Like, this is something that is, you know, shaping all of our lives. And until we, you know, we kind of are, in some ways, I feel like trying to take the place of public education, because we're not taught this in schools. And we really want to have people think about, you know, everything that we don't know about that history. And one of the things that, you know, was so striking to me when I did visit Germain's community and get to meet her family members and meet some of her friends and spend a little bit of time there. You know, you started off the program talking about some of the statistics around the rates of violence that Indigenous women and girls face, that, you know, 1 in 2 will experience some kind of sexual assault in their lifetime, or 84% experience some kind of violence. And those numbers are probably underreported, because a lot of this violence is unreported. But when I went to the Flathead Reservation, you know, every single woman and girl I talked to, you know, talked to me that they were a survivor of violence. And it's one thing, I think, to know the statistics, but it's another thing to see and hear a real person in front of you. And I think that when you know, a lot of what we're trying to do, or what I'm trying to do with the podcast, is create space for people to have empathy for Germain Charlot and for her Yaya Vicky and for her aunt Danny and her aunt Valinda or her friend Jocelyn, all of the other women that we meet who were, you know, part of Germain's life, as a way to kind of counter the othering that happens when you don't get an accurate representation of what it means to be Indigenous in the media. You know, I think that the podcast, you know, when you dive deeply into one person's story and you're able to tell it over 8 episodes. And, you know, I think that what we're trying to do is create space for people to, you know, see the full humanity of Germain's life and her family's life. And I think that's what I think we need to do to counter some of that othering that inevitably happens when all you see are racist and stereotypical depictions of what it means to be Indigenous in the U.S., which is so harmful. Like, it's such a harmful thing for people, if you're Indigenous, to feel like that's your only representation. And I feel like what's happening right now, like, that our podcast is a small part of what is a larger transformation in media that's happening right now, which is Indigenous people being supported in telling our own stories. Not just, you know, our podcast focuses very specifically on violence against Indigenous women and girls, but I look at Rutherford Falls, which is, you know, premiering and celebrating Indigenous humor and laughter, and Reservation Dogs, which is in production right now. Like, there's so many talented, creative Indigenous people storytellers that are out there right now, you know, taking space and amplifying our voices and creating space for Indigenous love and Indigenous joy. And I'm so excited to that's where we are in 2021. And I don't think there's any going back from here. We just need to keep moving forward.
I'm so glad you brought this up because I spent the weekend reading about Rutherford Falls. And this is a new Native comedy that you can watch on Peacock. And I still have to figure out how to sign up for that. But it's getting so much attention and it is so incredible. And Connie, I was actually going to ask you about this. I mean, you know, we get a lot of books on the show and I cannot keep up with the new books about Native history and contemporary Native history. I mean, it is so exciting. Such a wide range of books about the past and the present. And then your podcast and so many other podcasts, The Red Nation. I mean, there's incredible Native podcasts out there hosted by Native people, which is incredible. At the same time, I didn't want to bring this up with you, but I have to because this just happened. We just learned that the former U.S. Senator and CNN political commentator Rick Santorum was speaking to a very conservative group, the Young America's Foundation Summit, just recently. And he said, quote, "There was nothing here. I mean, yes, we have Native Americans, but candidly, there isn't much Native American culture in American culture. We came here and created a blank slate. We birthed a nation from nothing." End quote. He's, you know, he said the U.S. was founded as a Judeo-Christian theocratic state. I mean, this is a guy who is on CNN on a regular basis saying these horrific, ignorant, racist things.
And I feel like, you know, like that is almost nothing new. Like, I don't want to diminish the harm and hurt that causes because it is harmful and it is hurtful and it is racist and it is unacceptable, frankly, in 2021. But I feel like it proves the point of why we need, you know, a Rutherford Falls, why we need to support Indigenous people telling Indigenous stories, why we need to have podcasts about Jermaine Charlo and, you know, so many of the other Indigenous women and girls. Why we need to have, you know, books, telling our versions of American history, the truth really about American history, because, you know, we need to really inform and educate people. Like, that is just an ignorant, totally, deplorable understanding of the, you know, it's so harmful. And I think one of the I guess if there is a benefit, one of the benefits of it is that there, you know, my Twitter feed and my social media feed has been just, you know, inundated with people countering that and celebrating everything that all of the incredible diversity of Indigenous nations that existed here long before settlers came, you know, in Canada, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, the incredible diversity that exists across the United States in terms of geography and nations, but also the incredible contributions that we have made and continue to make. And I think that kind of erasure is also, you know, it's so dangerous and it's so harmful. And again, just makes the point of why we should be supporting and creating space and taking a look at who is in our newsrooms and taking a look at what kind of representation we're actually, you know, supporting in these newsrooms and taking a look at even in newsrooms, you know, where, you know, I've always been one of the only Indigenous people in, like, I've never gotten to work with another Indigenous producer. You know, I feel like we're making strides, we're making changes. You know, there are more of us than there have ever been in some ways, but we also, like, that's not enough. We need to be making sure that we're creating safe spaces for Indigenous people and creating space for them. You know, CNN should have an Indigenous contributor. You know, every major newsroom should, and not just one. We should have several. And the fact that, like, we've had this reckoning in media over the last couple of years around this issue of diversity, inclusion, and representation, you know, these are the kinds of things that still happen, you know, just shows how much work we have left to do.
Today, we're speaking with Connie Walker, an award-winning Cree journalist from Saskatchewan, Canada. Her new podcast with Gimlet Media is called Stolen, The Search for Germain. And I hope you can take some time to listen to this incredible podcast. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. It's about Germain Charlot, who went missing on June 16th, 2018, after leaving a bar in Missoula, Montana. She was only 23 at the time, a single mom to two young boys, Thomas and Jacob. Let's hear from Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The question that pops out for me is, based on we hear of so many incidences of these poor women, you know, being disappeared, but you never hear about, did they catch someone? Do they have some idea of who is doing this? Mm-hmm. Is there a particular group, or is it random?
Yeah, thank you for that question.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much the goal of the podcast, right? Is right on the first episode, we kind of take people back to that night in June. June 15th was the last night that Germain Charlot was out in downtown Missoula. She left this bar after midnight. And really, you know, I mean, I'm spending so much time today, I think, focusing on the context and focusing on the, you know, the bigger issues that impact, you know, a lot of Indigenous women and girls. But really, I think the focus of our podcast is also the kind of thrust of it. The central thread is trying to find answers and trying to understand what led to that night in June and what was happening in Germain's life. And I think that, you know, that's definitely, I feel like, you know, we're kind of walking this fine line with the podcast in a way, in that we're very much committed to like trying to find answers about Germain's disappearance and uncovering, you know, we speak a lot with the detective in her case about his theories about Germain Charlot. And I think that, you know, listeners will come away with an understanding of where the police investigation has been focused, for the last 2 years and where it is at right now. But I think that, you know, in terms of like trying to kind of, we're a true crime podcast, absolutely. But because we're also so aware and wanting to be including the important context, you know, we're trying to do both in this podcast. And I think that you know, obviously it's so important for Germain's family to find out that truth and to try to learn as much as they can and to get to be able to bring Germain home. And that's something that we were, you know, also really trying to, you know, give them, you know, get as much information as we could. And we were able to, I think, shed a lot of light on what the investigation has been into her disappearance. I'm trying to say this in a way that is not giving away too much in case people haven't a chance to listen to it.
Yeah, no, we didn't want to give away much because really it is just so gripping. And, you know, your question is important, and thanks for asking it, Stephen. One more question about it. According to the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls report, the National Crime Information Center reports that in 2016, there were 5,712 reports of missing Native women and girls, according to the DOJ. Only 116 of these cases were logged in the DOJ database. Mm. I mean, this is just shocking. So do we know if only 116 cases out of over 5,700 were logged, do we even have any idea how many were solved and who the perpetrators were?
I mean, I think it definitely speaks to the other, what I've seen referred to as like kind of a crisis of data, really, as well as like not having a sense of just how big the scope of this problem is. Because, you know, I mean, Flathead is very unique, I think, in terms of reservations, or the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes are unique in terms that of they don't have federal or BIA oversight on their reservation. So it's the local county sheriffs. So there are five of them on Flathead. So depending on where you are in the reservation, when you call police for help, you'd get up to one of five county sheriffs responding to your call. And I think that on some reservations, obviously they have tribal police and Bureau of Indian Affairs police. and federal oversight, but it's this kind of patchwork of jurisdictions and who's compiling and keeping track of data and then where it ends up, I feel like is a huge part of the problem. Like, so that really just, you know, being able to understand how big of an issue this is. I mean, certainly with Jermaine Charlot, and I don't know how many of those 5,000 cases, but what, you know, what police in Jermaine Charlot's, case told us was that, you know, most missing adults are found. Most missing adults, you know, eventually do contact somebody or, you know, eventually come home. And I think that that actually led to, that understanding or that belief, led to some delays in Jermaine's case. You know, Jermaine, the very next day after she was last seen, you know, her Yaya, her grandmother, Yaya is the Salish word for grandmother. Her Yaya was trying to call her and text her, and she wasn't responding. And she was immediately concerned because that was so unlike Jermaine. And Jermaine was always on social media. She was always on Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram, and her social media was quiet. And her family, you know, immediately was concerned, and they tried to report her missing, and they had delays, and you know, they reported her missing to the tribal police on Sunday, but she was last seen in Missoula, so they tried to get her reported to the Missoula Police Department, and they called, but then they were told they had to come in, so it ended up not happening for 5 days. And I think that, you know, what we uncovered in our, you know, investigation into Jermaine is that you know, there was eventually a detective who was assigned to investigate her disappearance, but that he worked on that case for a single day before he went on his weekend. And so it was really 11 days before somebody really from the Missoula Police Department started looking into what happened to Jermaine Charlot. And I think that part of that was because of this attitude or understanding that, you know, most adults come home. And I've reported on that in Canada as well. I remember Amber Tuckrow's family reported her missing and was told by the police that, oh, she's probably just out partying and she'll come back in a few days. Mm-mm. And her mother said her son is here, like her year old son. She wouldn't have left him alone. Something has happened. And the police ended up apologizing, you know, years later when, you know, Amber's remains were found, a couple of years after she went missing, and she's believed to be a victim of a homicide. But this is something that I think that absolutely is another part of the issue is really trying to understand the scope of the problem and scrutinize the police responses when this does happen.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I don't want to give a lot away, but definitely listen to the podcast and learn about the work that the Lifeguard Group does. This is an organization that fights human trafficking, which is a huge problem in Montana. And they actually put search groups together and placed flyers around town before the police did. Really, really an incredible group. Let's go to another caller, Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I got to say, Rick's in Santorum is repulsive in every way, and predominantly, I would say, because he adopted this mantle of populism to try to make himself popular. But he's a fascist, just like Trump. I'm not arguing against the principle of white supremacy, and I am hoping with your guest for the safe return of Jermaine Charlot. But I want to just observe kind of what Steve was talking about. I think maybe what he was getting at. The talk about the white colonialism or white supremacy in the context of this missing woman calls to mind a story I heard reported on the Pacifica station last night, where they're talking about black women who were so many percentage were victim of crime. And then they told this anecdote about a crime that happened in the past that white people were responsible for. And so I wish your guest well, and I want to amplify her point, but with this caveat, it just seems like there's a theme about caricaturizing race relations, casting all white people as settler colonials. And I think, but I would just like to say that as we have Deb Holland as a great example of indigenous person now.
Yeah, finally, in the year 2020. I mean, it's taken so long. I want to give Connie some. We're almost out of time. So, Connie, what is your response? Thanks for calling in.
I mean, I think that for sure we just need to have a better understanding of the realities that Indigenous women experience. I think that what your caller is getting at is obviously this is not a black or white issue. This is many shades of gray. Indigenous women are more likely to be assaulted by white men than any other group. That's one of the unfortunate and sad statistics out there. But certainly there is violence within Indigenous communities as well. I'm not at all trying to say that that's not part of a problem. But I think that what we're really getting at is that we need to understand more. We need to know more. We need to amplify more of these stories. And we need to learn about women like Jermaine Charlo in order to understand the scope of the problem so we can begin to start addressing it.
And also, intergenerational trauma and intergenerational violence is directly connected to the past. I mean, this doesn't happen to everyone who loses their language and their culture and their land, but it does happen, and it's important to add that context.
Absolutely, yeah. And this shared experience among so many Indigenous people does speak to this history of colonization and does speak to this history of institutional racism. And that's something, you know, that we need to learn about and we need to acknowledge. And so, you know, I'm grateful for people for asking the questions and for listening and for creating space to learn.
Well, Connie, again, huge thanks to you and your team for this incredible podcast. You do great work, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your support.
Connie Walker is an award-winning Cree journalist from Saskatchewan, Canada, and host of the podcast Stolen, The Search for Jermaine. You can find more information, and I hope you can take the time to listen to this podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Dee Miner for engineering our show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.